Hi everyone, Steve Rose with AnarchistStandard.com. Today I have an interview that I recently did with James Corbett. James runs CorbettReport.com. And if you haven't seen his work before, James provides a really original and unique service in breaking current events down and providing historical context and drawing out the sort of story behind the story about what's happening in the world scene in a way that I don't think any other media organization or service does. So highly encourage you to visit Corbett Report and even subscribe to his website to help James continue to provide that service and even expand on it. Our interview, unfortunately, was limited on time, so we didn't get a chance to get into a lot of the stuff that I would have liked to have talked to him about, but perhaps that could be a subject for another interview at a later date. But I hope you enjoy this interview with James Corbett. Hi everyone, this is Steve Rose with AnarchistStandard.com, and today I'm very pleased to welcome James Corbett to the podcast. For those who don't know, James is a prolific podcaster, blogger, and journalist, and his website, The Corbett Report, is one of the leading vehicles of the emerging open source news movement, which hopefully is something we'll talk about in the next hour. I could say from a personal perspective, I've been a huge fan of James's for many years and a subscriber to his website. So it's a really pleasure to welcome James Corbett to the podcast. James, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
Good. The idea behind the series of interviews is to try to capture at this moment in time leading anarchists, you could say professional anarchists, their ideas about what people should do to bring about a free society. So people like yourself who have studied history, who are thinking about, who are excited about the ideas of a free society and also worried about where we could be going if we don't turn things around. What would you think people should do to start bringing about that world? And I know you've done a lot of work and I've seen some of your podcasts about solutions, so I want to get into that. But maybe before we do that, if you could just help me out by giving a little bit more of an extended introduction to yourself. I'm particularly interested to know how you came to anarchism, so your ideological development, and also if you have any insights into what it was about you where you were exposed to these ideas and they were so impactful that it made you want to commit yourself to, you know, try make a livelihood out of spreading these ideas, which is pretty unique, whereas most people might be exposed to these ideas and, you know, maybe say it's interesting but not necessarily commit to them like you do.
Well, it's, by way of introduction, my name is James Corbett. I'm at CorbettReport.com, but I am a Canadian by birth, and that means I'm a socialist by birth, basically, socialist by osmosis. And so I grew up in Alberta, basically Texas of the North, and lived there my whole life until 22 years old, I think. I went to Ireland for a year to study Anglo-Irish literature, and then ultimately ended up in Japan teaching English. It was just going to be for a year. 1 year turns into two. 2 years turns into 10. And we're here in 12th year of living in Japan. Now I have a family out here. So I guess my journey towards this started more or less in 2006 when I started encountering information online in the conspiracy theory world. Ooh, Twilight Zone music, please. Basically, information about 9/11 and other events like that I wasn't seeing reflected anywhere in any of the mainstream media programming I was consuming at the time. And I thought, well, that's strange. And here we are in an incredible moment of time. Truly nothing like this has happened before in history, where the average person sitting in their living room in Japan has the opportunity to speak to thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, occasionally millions of people. That is an exceptionally remarkable thing that's happening. So I had never in my life even had the idea of starting a website before, but once I started to encounter all this crazy information, I'm like, oh, I've got to start something. So I started the Corbett Report in order to do that. And of course, when for me, I mean, I'm sure it's different for everyone, but for me, when I started really looking into the dirty underbelly of the state and the things that are done in the name of the state, but it's really the deep state that puppeteers the state, all of that kind of conspiracy theory, spooky music, please, my only reaction to that was, oh, okay, everything I've ever been fed about the state and how it loves you and everything is wonderful and peachy and it, you know, farts unicorns out of its farts rainbows out of its unicorn ass is total bunk. It's total lie. Right. The state is there to as a layer of control and as a type of escape valve for people to make them feel like they have some sort of control over the system. They don't. It's the bankers and the people at the top who control society, and they use the political puppets as a convenient way of making people invest in that system and feel like they have some part of it. Once I started to figure that out, I mean, it was pretty obvious to me that, well, okay, so everything I thought I knew about politics has to be wrong. Mm-hmm. So all of this, you know, kind of democratic socialist kind of Canadian bunkum that I grew up with has to be wrong. And that's when I started exploring the idea of human freedom and the real political axis, not this left-right, you know, political football nonsense that we've been told our whole lives, but the up-down axis. It's the libertarian versus tyrannical kind of axis that that has been the excluded axis, the one that they don't want you to think about and they don't want you to associate with, because it's pretty obvious when you put it plainly to people, do you want freedom or do you want to live under a tyranny? People want freedom, but we never asked to look at that that dichotomy when we're trying to pick our political puppets, because again, it leads you in the direction of thinking, I don't want anything to do with this process of picking political puppets. So really, I mean, at that point, 2006, 2007, I started the website. I think I was along the path towards that journey. But it was several years before I even picked up the word anarchist. I mean, still, it was, I mean, no, those are those crazy black bloc people who go to and throw bombs at protests and stuff and whatever. I mean, you know, oh, I don't want anything to do with that. What I want is, you know, something like, oh, I don't know, return to a constitutional government or whatever, blah, blah, blah. The kind of, you know, I was obviously influenced by a lot of the American programming I was consuming at that time. But I mean, what's the difference between a libertarian and an anarchist a few years if you're honest? And that was the case for me. So I started going down that hole and eventually, you know, encountering the work of people like Larkin Rose and Stefan Kinsella and other people who've really done yeoman's work in waking people up to these issues. It was just a matter of time and a matter of being honest with myself to realize, oh, okay, yeah, I don't believe in government authority. There is no legitimacy to this mob that is the government. So I guess it's anarchism. Okay. All right. So now it's, and now I'm in the process of orienting myself within that field, because obviously there's a wide range of anarchisms and a lot of things that fall under that umbrella. And I don't claim to have it all sorted out myself. Mm-hmm. I don't think I have the definitive answer to all of my questions. I think I'm still exploring it. And I think that's actually helpful for my audience, my podcast audience, because they can explore these issues along with me. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps the dialogue and the conversation flow. So that might be a long-winded answer, but basically that's how I've ended up at the point that I am right now.
But I mean, it makes a lot of sense. That's sort of what happened with me too. You know, you just sort of follow the ideas as they come and you're open to it. But many people do not let themselves go to that extent. And why do you think, it's because you were a professional blogger already? So it was sort of like, you know, you had, I mean, what is it that made, I always wonder about this because there's a lot of libertarians who adamantly will not say I'm an anarchist, and it doesn't, to me it doesn't, it's like you're saying, it's the logical progression of the ideas. It's the only consistent philosophy. So, I mean, why do you think that is? Or it's
self-psychologizing is maybe not my forte, but I am interested in doing what I do because I truly want to know the truth. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's an agenda behind truly wanting to know how the world really works. I think that just is an innate thing that some people have. And I don't want to put myself on a pedestal. I mean, we all play tricks with ourselves and we all, you know, convince ourselves of certain things and we all get led down blind ideological alleys. Mm-hmm. But I guess I don't know what is the difference between someone who will abandon what they have held true for for their whole life to the point that it becomes their identity and people who don't. But I think for me, perhaps the main hurdle was that hurdle in that transition going, oh, okay, the deep state exists. Everything I thought I knew about the way politics works was a lie. Once you understand that and you fall down that hole, at that point, you at least can have the self-awareness to be able to say, I have been completely wrong about what I believed in the past. It could happen again in the future. Let me explore this. Mm-hmm. And when you start to get into that sort of I'm falling down the hole, you know, where am I? I think it's at that point where you can be honest with yourself and apply the logic of the situation. So for people who have been, I guess, grown up in a libertarian milieu or environment or been sort of that way most of their lives, maybe it's a different process for them because they've never had to fundamentally question what they hold true. But for me, as I say, I mean, I kind of joke about it, but really, I mean, Canada is pretty socialist and in a lot of ways, and that's just the default political programming of people growing up in the Canadian system. And that was mine. And that, you know, the state's a great thing. So when I overcame that and confronted it and rejected it, that's a huge mental hurdle to cross over so that the other hurdles along the way aren't so huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the first hurdle that's
first
the big one.
Uh-huh. Well, plus, since you're living in Japan, you're already kind of outside. I mean, you know, you're a Westerner living in Japan, so it's kind of like everything is different anyway, you know. So do you think that it's a matter of age? Because I mean, I often think that, you know, it's a totally different way of seeing the world. You have to be in an anarchist society. You have to be responsible for yourself, you know, and to a certain extent, if somebody's, you say, over a certain age, it's can they really rewire their mind at that age to think in this totally different way, you know? And sometimes I wonder if it's just, well, there's no way. Do you think there's a way? Do you think that we would be able to convert people over a certain age, or it's just we should just write them off? You know, it's just some people say that, you know.
I don't think there's any fundamental law of the universe that people cannot change their political ideology after a certain age. I think it probably does become more difficult.
Right.
But hey, we're anarchists. We treat people as individuals. So
sure.
I'm not going to make some blanket statement about what can or cannot be done. I'm sure there are people who do change their minds, even late in life. So treat everyone as an individual. Treat everyone as being capable of understanding basic truths and logic. And if they can't, then that's on them. That's not on us.
Definitely. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about your work? I mean, maybe I'll just tell you that I really enjoy the level of detail you go into in analyzing current events and how you interlace history into that. Do you want to talk maybe a little bit about what you're doing, what the Corbett Report's all about, and maybe some initiatives you're working on now?
Sure. Well, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have along it. I guess if I was self-describing my work, I would say the Corbett Report is pretty much just a reflection of all my interests and whatever I'm interested in. So it is wide-ranging. It deals with a lot of different subjects, usually in the political realm, but the political realm, I guess, could be almost anything, social and historical and issues of science and just all of these different pieces of a puzzle that I think all do come together at the idea that has been the idea that has been one of the guiding forces and organizing forces of human civilization since the beginning of civilization, which is the quest of the very few to rule over the very many. And there are people, I guess, who are trapped in the political fairy tales of our time who believe that we have transcended that. And now we're living in this, you know, democratic age where it's all so different. Again, I would hope your listeners have overcome that hurdle if they're listening to the anarchist standard. But that's the box that we've been placed in. And I think all of these various different issues that I look at, where it's history and society and science and the news and daily events, all of them are of a piece, and they all are reflective of an oligarchy that exists today that is trying to steer our society into the perfect prison, the perfect society of total control, which is now becoming technologically feasible with the types of technologies that we have for smart grid control of every aspect of everything that we do, total tracking and surveillance of everything that we do. Oh, but wait, that's a conspiracy theory. Oh, and then, you know, people discover the NSA really is listening to everything you say and all of this. And now it's just commonly accepted and people go along with it. So I'm looking at that as as basically, yes, this total picture of a very few people trying to rule the vast majority of humanity, and it becoming technologically and technically feasible in a way it's never been before in human history. So we're at an extremely important time. But as I say, counteracting that is, for example, the ability for me sitting here in Japan to talk to you in the United States mm-hmm. and people wherever in the world they're listening to this, however they're listening to this. Again, we do have this remarkable opportunity, at least for this window of time. So I'm trying to make the most of that. And that's really the core of what I do at the Corbett Report.
This is a question I've often thought about. You know, think about the psychology of these people, because I agree with you. There's definitely a movement, and one thing I liked about your podcast is you talk about this movement to a world government, and I think a lot of people in our movement are not willing to go to that point and say, this is where they are trying to get us to. This is what they want. They're not going to say it. But, I mean, do you think that they're deliberately thinking, I want to control people, or is it almost like they just think that – it would be good if they were in charge because they're good people and they're doing this like for our benefit, you know, because like there's crazy Putin out there and if he takes over, everyone's gonna be screwed, but I'm a good guy, you know? Or do you think like how much of it is deliberate, just pure evil on their part, and how much of it is like just foolish, you know what I mean? They're trying to do good in this weird, using this evil system.
Yes, I understand the distinction you're making. I think both exist.
Yeah.
In fact, even other possibilities exist. I don't think we should reduce it to any one, because different people at various layers of control with various, you know, powers, levels of power, have their own motivations and their own understandings. I'm sure there are people who are in it for their own personal profit mm-hmm. in a monetary sense.
Right.
There are people who are in it who are in it for the idea of power and control. There are people who are in it for quasi-religious reasons. Mm-hmm. There's almost this kind of religious sentiment towards, you know, the uniting of global government. I was just looking at this Maurice Strong character who, if people haven't heard of him, they should check out his biography. It is insanity, the number of different institutions and organizations that he helped to found and direct, and most of them kind of environmental organizations, but he himself was a millionaire from the Alberta oil patch. I mean, just a crazy, crazy story. But he also had this kind of religious aspect to what he was doing, and he has some kind of crazy New Age beliefs and something about, whatever energies and blah, and there's some, you know, prophecy about
right.
ruling
yeah,
the world and that kind of stuff. So I think there's so many different motivations for different people at different mm-hmm. levels of this system. But one thing that I would caution against is trying to psychologize people in positions of power as if they think like you or I,
right.
because there is psychopathy, which does affect a certain percentage of the population. People argue over what percentage, but fundamentally, psychopaths do not have the motivations that you or I would, and do not think like you or I would, do not have the ability to sympathize or empathize with other human beings, or treat other beings as anything other than objects. And so for people like that to try to psychologize them from our perspective is probably, I mean, fruitless. In a way, they're just kind of the perfect killers or societal manipulators, social engineers. I mean, what kind of person desires power over other people? It's not a person who thinks in the way that you or I think. So I think trying to scrutinize their motives might be almost fruitless at a
right.
certain level. But again, as I say, there are different people involved at different layers of this agenda that have different motivations.
But I mean, ultimately, they all do disrespect the average person, because they're all saying you can't manage your life as well as I can. I mean, you know, and therefore I'm empowered to do this to you for your own good, you know? So, I don't know. What do you think? I mean, the next step you've written about this, like, is, I guess, try to create a unified world currency, right? That would be their next step. I mean, what do you think the time frame is? Obviously, we don't know, but I mean, we're going to see in our lifetime the first, you know, confederation of states where they're going to have a world unified currency, and, you know, we're all going to have a vote. But, you know, what do you think?
Well, coming into this from the outside, obviously, not privy to whatever kinds of discussions are going on in the inner sanctums of power and in the Bilderberg meetings and whatever other meetings we don't even know about that exist. But coming at it from the outside, I can only think about what is most effective from the perspective, if you wanted to create a global government and a global unified currency and whatever, how would you go about doing it? What would be the most effective route? And honestly, I think that it would make more sense, for example, if we're looking at the monetary system, it would make more sense to have a system that is structured like something like the IMF's special drawing rights, which is a basket of currencies. The yuan has just been added to it, but it's the Japanese yen, the US dollar, the British pound, and the European euro. And this is a type of monetary instrument. It's not exactly a currency. It's a claim that central banks can hold in reserve, and then they can use that claim against any one of those currencies. So they can take that SDR and convert it into dollars or yen or euros or whatever. And so it's something that only affects the central banks. Only central banks and those types of institutions trade in them or have any ability to use them. It doesn't affect you or I on the daily, you know, level. We're still going to be buying things at the store with our dollars or yen or pesos or whatever. But the entire international system could be organized in such a way that there is something between the central banks that acts as a reserve or whatever that, again, doesn't affect what our money looks like or feels like in our kind of day-to-day interactions. And I think that would probably be the most effective way of bringing in this type of system, because if you bring in, you know, here's the, you know, world currency or whatever, I mean, there's no way to do that, to introduce that to people in any other way than now, you know, everyone is under this authority. But if you keep everyone with their kind of local flavor of currency and it looks like it's kind of centrally controlled, or locally controlled, who on earth knows what special drawing rights are even, or how they function, or what they are, and who cares, right? I mean, if it's all done behind the scenes, people don't ever try to look into the box and see what's going on in there. So I think that would probably be the most effective way to at least introduce the infrastructure for that. And maybe somewhere down the road, they reveal, you know, the kind of world currency system, but they don't have to do that right away.
So I guess just to continue this thought experiment, so they get the IMF sets, or some world organization sets up the special draw. I mean, are they going to have a world bank that's going to have, you know, be like the Federal Reserve for the world kind of thing? Maybe, you know, it's located in Beijing or something like that. Like,
well, I mean, there already is a central bank of central banks, the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. And it operates, I mean, under its own authority, its own jurisdiction. The Swiss government doesn't have any jurisdiction over the building that the Bank for International Settlements is housed in. They can't go and raid the offices or anything. I mean, it is its own entity, and it's, again, it's one of those things that few people have heard of and fewer still understand what it is or what it does. So there already are these types of institutions and organizations out there, and we could extrapolate forward from what exists to look at how they would just extend their control. So we could look at some sort of system that is controlled by the Bank for International Settlements, that is administered through something like the United Nations, using something like the IMF special drawing rights. I don't think it necessarily has to be the special drawing rights. It doesn't have to be the UN. It doesn't have to be the Bank for International Settlements. But these are the kinds of institutions that we could imagine taking those roles. But yes, I mean, I think ultimately this has to be consolidated under some sort of governing body like the United Nations. And I think it would involve the creation of a global tax. That, I think, is really the cornerstone of global government. And however they do that, however they institute it, under whatever guise, in whatever way, I think that's really the point at which you start looking at global government, rather than global governance, which is that, you know, airy-fairy phrase that they like to try to pawn off on people as if it means anything other than global government. The cornerstone of global government is global tax. So I look at something like UN-administered carbon tax or something along those lines as the foot in the door. And it doesn't matter how tiny it is. Once that is instituted, it's just a question of expanding and expanding and expanding.
And do you think that there are also, it kind of seems behind the scenes that they're trying to destroy this idea of national sovereignty. And, you know, as anarchists, like, I don't really consider myself an American, but I'd prefer to be an American than a world citizen, you know? And is that, I guess you see that, right?
That's, well, I would rather be a human being rather than an American or a world citizen or Japanese or a Canadian. So I think this is such an important point because I think this is one of the rabbit holes that people get caught in or caught down, or they get caught chasing the wrong trail, because it seems okay. So the powers that shouldn't be want to organize a world structure, some sort of global institution, global government of some sort. So the answer to that must be to fight back. Oh, well, we have to be nationalists. Right. We have, you know, that's what we, and, you know, put all your identity and power and energy in the state. You know, the glorious national state is going to save us from this. It's a false dichotomy. It is a false dichotomy because nationalism is just the stepping stone towards a global government of some sort, some sort of global structure. All they have to do is replace that American flag that you worship with a UN flag and now worship this flag. And if they can get you to do that, then mission solved. I mean, it ultimately, this is a battle for hearts and minds.
Right.
And whatever, you know, kind of institution they put down on people, if it is simply just a, you know, you do what we say and you worship us now, that's not going to work. They have to make you want it. So they make you want these national governments and put your energy and identity in them, and then they just, you know, and then it's a regional thing, and then it's a global thing. So that's a false dichotomy, and it leads us down a false path. The answer to globalism is not nationalism.
Right.
The answer to globalism is decentralization, is giving up this idea that you can put yourself in some sort of amorphous collective that's going to be ruled over democratically or by other some kind of hocus-pocus nonsense that is ever going to be reflective of who you are and is ever going to respect your fundamental who you are as a human being,
right.
i.e. all of the natural rights that that entails. So I think, yes, nationalism is absolutely the wrong way to combat this global government type of agenda.
But I mean, thinking about that, like if our ultimate goal is to we want to be individually sovereign, right? And everything is voluntary. But let's say that, you know, you say all government is illegitimate, which is our position, and therefore you meet the local politician, your town mayor, whatever. You're like, you know, you're a bad guy. You should step down. You should let us rule ourselves, right? Well, now you no longer have an ally in your alliance against the state. I'm saying U.S. state government, you know, because you don't like the state government, you hate the state government even more, right? And you do the same thing at the state level, and then you no longer have the state government now fighting the feds, right? So, I mean, this is, you know, to just strip everything off and say I'm an individual, that is our position, but from a strategic perspective, if we're going to de-escalate and break things up, you know, don't we have to think about these different levels, you know, and sort of calibrate our anger towards the bigger aggregates. You see what I'm saying? Or
I do see what you're saying. And I think as long as we are 100% clear about that strategy, that it is a strategy and that we are making a certain alliance of convenience in order to forward a certain idea of human liberty, I don't have any particular problem with that. But people can lose sight of the fact that it is a strategy and an alliance of convenience and actually start investing themselves and their identity in that and actually getting, you know, excited about that. I mean, for example, nullification is something that I've talked about on my program as being an awesome idea for trying to, you know, to combat NSA surveillance or whatever, nullify the NSA. A wonderful idea. It does mean an alliance of convenience with state legislatures in order to get things passed, in order to, you know, defund or otherwise hamper the federal government. But again, it's really only a strategy that's being employed for a specific end. And as long as people keep that in mind, I'm happy about that. But if we start to lose sight of that and we start to think the end goal is to try to create state governments, yay, that's better than national governments, it's better than global governments. Again, I think we have to understand it's part of a process of decentralization and not lose sight of that.
So would you be, I mean, did you say that it's like a politician, let's say there's a politician who says, I'm an anarchist, like he's very explicit about it, like my ultimate goal is the elimination of the government, but he goes along with a lot of stuff, right? Then does that make him more forgivable in our eyes? He's still living off of our work. He's, you know, not fighting against these people on every chance he can because he's, what do you think? I mean,
Yeah, well, look, I'm not going to put myself in the position of telling other anarchists what to do, even if they would listen. If there are people who want to pursue the political stratagem of trying to promote liberty, and they think that it can be fruitful, and they think they can win, you know, pieces here and there, I'm not going to stop them. I'm not going to participate in it. I'm not going to give myself or my time or energy into that, because I do not care one iota of whether or not the we'll have a kinder, gentler slave master. That's not my agenda. And I think once you start dabbling with that, you're going down that road. And, you know, to a certain extent, you're investing your identity in the political collective. And so for me, I'm not going to participate in it. But I'm aware of the fact that, for example, we all have different propensities and we all have different abilities. I think my propensities are probably in the communicative line, I hope. And so that's why I do what I do. There are other people who have artistic propensities, so they can spread these ideas through books or music or that type of thing, and that's awesome. There are people who have networking abilities, and maybe they can use those in a political sphere. So I'm not against people attempting to further liberty through whatever means they have, but I'm not going to participate in that personally. And I mean, again, I'm not making dictates for anyone, not that anyone in the anarchist community would listen to me if I did.
So what was you, so that maybe getting more to the main point here, like what do you think people should do? You know, you think about these ideas a lot. You've been involved in this a lot. You've seen successes from history. You know, what should people do? It's like, I'm busy. I have a regular life, but like I'm interested in these ideas. Like, how can I help?
Excellent question. All of my solutions are geared towards things that individuals can do at their individual level. And they're not things that are going to overthrow the entire social order overnight or anything of that sort. They're things that are steps along the way, and they can be tiny baby steps or larger steps, depending on how much time and ability people have. But I like to concentrate on those types of ideas. So things that I've talked about, a lot of things about economics or monetary systems, because I think ultimately so much of this comes down to that, because economics isn't about numbers and you know, dollars or whatever. It's about human interaction fundamentally, and how we transact and interact with each other is the structure of our society, and so much of that is entailed by that, which is of course why they love to have central banks that, you know, dictate what currencies we are or not allowed to use in what ways and what transactions. I mean, that is the power over the people in some very fundamental ways, psychologically, socially, economically. So the ways that we can skirt that or get around that or try to interact with each other outside of that system, I think, are extremely important. And we have to start setting up those infrastructures or expanding them where they already exist. And often they already exist. So I've talked about local and complementary and alternative currencies. I've talked about cryptocurrencies. I've talked about peer-to-peer economy and agorism as sort of the method or way that we can get outside of this system. And I think those types of strategies are extremely important. I've also talked about all sorts of other things that people can be doing on the kind of local individual level. I've talked about how to make your own media. As I say, we are in this incredible age where you can reach millions of people potentially, you know, just sitting in your living room. That's pretty amazing. So I would hope more people would get involved with that if they have any kind of ability communicatively. I've talked about ways to subvert what's happening. For example, I mean, we know about the surveillance problem, which is, I mean, clearly a problem. There is this centralized authority which claims to have the ability to peer into everything that we are doing and examine it at all times, but they like to claim national security over all sorts of information and things like that. So subverting that, turning it on its head, instead of surveillance, suvalence, we should be turning the camera around on the agents of the state in whatever way, literally with actual cameras that we can now use and Ustream live, you know, events that are happening so that they can't scrub the tapes and things like that. That's important. It is important to fight their fire with that fire. And so ideas like that, that can monkey wrench the system. And then things that we have to think about in terms of lines of communication, always important in any struggle. And of course, if our line of communication is the internet, it's not a very secure one, as we've seen with SOPA and PIPA and ACTA and you know, all TPP has things to do with the ways that we can or cannot share information on the internet. We know they're legislatively trying to crack down on ways that we can communicate with each other. So we have to start looking for internet alternatives or ways that we can back up what we're saying and doing in a non-controllable way. So I've talked about wireless mesh networking and ideas like that, that people can start looking into implementing at least in their own communities as a way of expanding it. And as with so many of these ideas, like local currencies or barter or farmers markets or growing vegetables in your garden, all of these ideas can be tiny little things that make a very small difference even to your own life, let alone your community. Or you can imagine how they can start to create the infrastructure for a completely different way of living and interacting with other human beings. And when we have that bigger idea in mind, to me, it's really the question of whether we're going to just lockstep march into whatever kind of system is being constructed with everything that we're talking about, with the, you know, smart grid and controlled currencies and all of that, or whether we're going to take the steps right now to create the communities that can be the answer to that. And it's a question that's really, I think, extremely important, because as I say, the technology is reaching that point where I think in the next generation or two, we're going to be facing some huge decisions as a species with regards to automation taking over most of manual labor and even some non-manual labor and things like that, and gene editing and all of this stuff that's coming up right now. There's a huge bifurcation that's going to happen in our society, and either we are ready for it or we're not. And if we're not, we're just going to fall into whatever pre-planned solution the powers that shouldn't be.
I like that expression. I wanted to ask you, when you said like the counter-surveillance, going back and putting the light back on them, but the problem is that that's a lot of work, because you got to, you know, it's just like the NSA has a tremendous amount of resources. They can observe us all, and they can do like massive searches on all of our emails or whatever. But you know, you can go and like follow a politician, hire a private investigator, and to trace the lines, he's doing this because of this, takes a lot of resources, right? And we don't have the resources. So how do we get around that? I mean, obviously you have found a way to do it, which is great, but it's very difficult to just sort of crowdsource people. It's so hard to get people to pay money for this kind of stuff. You can't tax people for freedom, unfortunately. So
unfortunately, yeah. I say,
well, you know what I mean. Unfortunately.
Yeah, I know what you mean though. Yeah. I mean, it's not a fair fight. Absolutely, it's not a fair fight. We're fighting with both hands tied behind our backs, and you know, we're always at a disadvantage. But our advantage is, I really think there are many, many, many more of us, however you define us, against them, however you define them. Again, there are people who are actively looking to try to consolidate control over as many people as possible, and there are a lot of people who come under that umbrella who are not, I think, themselves motivated by evil cruelty, but just want to get along in the system, so they will go along with whatever sort of institutional structure exists. And I think they're ultimately probably more likely to be on our side than on the side of, you know, would-be bloodthirsty tyrants, if only they saw the struggle in that way. So it's kind of like the Matrix, where everyone is a potential Agent Smith, you know, waiting to pull you back into the Matrix if you get a little too uppity. But they're not fundamentally bad people, I think. So I think there is a much larger base of us, and it is a question of, again, motivating people to understand that, yes, one or two people doing this absolutely is not going to make any difference whatsoever. Right. But entire communities structured around this, and again, we're even living in an age where community doesn't necessarily have to mean a bunch of people living in the same geographical place. It could be spread out across the globe. But that kind of decentralized nodal network system of different people in different places contributing towards this, again, not even in a necessarily networked or centrally planned way, more like in the Hayekian sense of just
emergent,
spontaneous order, people doing things in their own way in different places will create the opportunities for subversion of the system. So again, one person, you know, trying to follow around a politician or whatever, it's not going to make a much of a difference. Mm-hmm. But if you have entire communities of people organized around ideas like this, so when you get into a, you know, cop watch type of thing or something, that can be an effective organization, because many hands make light work. And again, it's never going to be fair. I mean, the NSA or whatever is always going to have vastly superior technology and know-how and backdoors that, you know, most people will have no idea of. So I don't think we should ever expect it's going to be a fair fight. But at any rate, we can make it into an interesting one.
Mm-hmm. What role do you think are maybe, because most of the solutions you put forward, agorism, peer-to-peer, surveillance and just showing what they're doing. I mean, they're mostly sort of trying to work around the system, finding ways to evade. But what role do you think that, you know, the moral message should have as far as trying to shame people who support the state, shame people who work for the state, shame people who, you know, have promote their politician? This is a question I like to ask people, because to me, it seems like that's a very effective method, but people don't like to do it because they don't like to judge people. But to a certain extent, we do need to express to people like that. We don't approve of what you're doing, you know, and we need to make it hurt for people. What do you think about that?
Yes, I understand that idea, and I don't have any qualm with it.
Yeah.
Morally, I mean, if people want to create communities of interest where they shun people outside of that who, you know, have different ideologies, there's nothing obviously morally wrong with that. I don't know how effective that is, ultimately. Uh-huh. And it's not just a practical thing, I guess. But, I mean, I'm thinking in my own experience, my own life, in my actual day-to-day life, right, here in Japan, not the people I interact with online, but in my day-to-day life, I know maybe a couple of people who might kind of lean towards something somewhat like an anarchist, you know, toe in the water.
Oh, really?
Of anarchy.
They don't follow your work? They don't watch it?
I have a couple of friends that watch my work and agree with a lot of stuff I say, don't agree with other stuff. Mm. I don't ever expect that anyone's going to be agreeing with me 100%. Mm. So I'm thinking, in my own life, am I willing to shun and sacrifice all of my friends and family and people that I love because they don't see the bigger picture yet?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point. For me, because I look at my own experience of this, I was in my mid-20s before it even dawned on me that human liberty was an important thing. I mean, that's the extent of the brainwashing operation that people are under. So I never, ever want to look at people who have been intellectually crippled as being, you know, that I should blame them for being intellectually crippled.
But
I'm going to blame the people who are crippling them and show people that they are being crippled. And whatever they might want to make of that, that's up to them. I mean, I don't put that on myself that they don't understand or they don't see the bigger picture. All I can do is try to communicate this information. And I do try to communicate this information. What people do with it is up to them. Mm-hmm. But I want to not speak down to people, because I am not on a pedestal. I do not have it all figured out. I'm not the most, you know, perfect human being who's ever existed. And I understand that the kinds of roadblocks, mental roadblocks that have been put in place are extremely effective at keeping people who are fundamentally, I think, good people,
right,
from understanding this evil system that has been constructed around them that they are complicit in. And I think it's more effective, more fruitful, more hopeful to think that we can convince people of that rather than simply social shunning. I understand the idea of,
right,
social shunning as a way of getting people to realize that there's something going on here that's important. And maybe there is a point at which that becomes necessary. Once you start moving into more authoritarian systems, absolutely you have to start shunning the people who are going along with those authoritarian systems. If they're acting as the jailers of the watchmen of the state, literally or figuratively, mm-hmm, yes, you have to start doing that. But I don't know if we're at that point.
But doesn't the guilt kind of go to doesn't it pervade like to the masses? I mean, to the general public, because you can't give people a free pass. It seems to me, to a certain extent, we're all guilty. I'd say I'm not guilty because I am an anarchist and I say it's wrong and I'm very open about that. But people who are not, it's just your ignorance hurts me. And when I put the ideas in front of you, I'm not going to talk down to you, but when I put the ideas in front of you and you ignore it and it doesn't change your mind, you know, you just, like Ayn Rand said, blank out, you know.
Well, let me
what
ask
else
you.
Can I do except to be angry about it?
Let me
that.
Ask you a question. Do you pay taxes?
Well, when I was
I'm never talking to you again. That's it.
Huh?
You pay taxes. Oh,
Well, I say, like, you know, if a guy gets, if you get held up on the street,
who is on the pedestal that can tell other people that they should be shunned because you go along with this? I mean, I get it, but I mean, I still pay taxes and stuff, but I have to do that.
Well, you judge a guy.
We're all in this.
Do you judge a guy who gives a mugger his wallet on the street?
Sorry?
If a guy gives his wallet to a mugger on the street, do you judge him?
No. Oh, but that's my point. That's my point.
Well,
I mean, everyone
right.
is in this system to a certain extent, whether they like it or not, because the gun is metaphorically or literally at their head.
Oh, but I mean, as long as they're saying I don't like it, that's, you know.
Well, then it's just about paying a piety. Okay, as long as you say the right thing, then I won't shun you.
True.
I mean, what's the point of that?
That's
I want
true.
People to understand it in their bones, in the core of who they are, what it means to be a free human being, and what the value of that
right.
is. And when they understand that, there's no turning that off. There's no turning that around. So that's
people,
the hope.
But people have an incentive not to know, you know, and that's kind of the challenge we have, right? Because being an anarchist is, especially nowadays, maybe you don't see this, but this is like your profession. But for just the average person, you say I'm an anarchist. Most people are not like really intellectual, right? So that means if I'm saying I'm an anarchist, all of a sudden people are going to start to ask me questions. I'm going to have to defend it. So it's better for me not to go down that path. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I understand. I don't use the term anarchist generally, only in a context like this, where I know you know what it means, I know the audience know what it means, but I don't usually tend to use that word because it has all of the baggage, and it's an impediment to communication.
Mm.
It doesn't help me communicate my ideas or what I stand for.
Mm.
It only gives people a false image 99% of the
right.
time. So depending on the context and who I'm talking to, I mean, I'll phrase it in a way that I hope they'll understand. Or I prefer the term voluntarism because
right.
anarchism is everything from ANCOM to ANCAP.
Right.
To,
voluntarism
all
gets
the different,
better. It's,
yeah. So voluntarism is the core of kind of the moral basis for what I believe. So that's the better way to start introducing it to people in the general public.
So then when you talk to people do you mostly focus on specific issues and say, look, this guy did this, this is why he's doing this, and this is and try to get them on that level and not abstract it to be a voluntarist, be against the government categorically? Or do you, you know, do you do both? Just curious, I mean.
It's case by case. Depends on the individual. It also depends on the context of the conversation.
Right.
I don't just randomly start going off spouting against the state in random conversations. Mm-hmm. But certainly when it's appropriate, I will absolutely not hold back about my views. If I'm questioned about my views, of course, I'll talk about them openly. But then it depends on the context of the situation. If we're talking about a certain issue and there's something that I have to say about that issue, of course, I'll say it. So, again, I mean, it just requires a bit of social intelligence, just basic modicum of social
right.
intelligence to understand what is an appropriate way of bringing this type of information to others and what's kind of weird.
It's a question that has come up in other interviews, though, is can we achieve the transition to a free society without people explicitly understanding the principles that we believe in? Or like, because some of the things you talk about in your solutions, like Airbnb, Uber, and these peer-to-peer, they're almost unconsciously moving us in that direction. But do you think we can achieve that world without people understanding the philosophy?
No.
You don't?
Because although I do see the things like that, the things that technology can enable in the peer-to-peer economy as being a move towards – away from the state and towards agorism somehow, right? But if we don't consciously understand what it is, why it's important, what it's doing, then it will be regulated. It will be controlled. It will be cracked down on in some way. They'll find a way to blunt it in some manner through some sort of restriction or regulation. And most people will be like, oh, okay, well, I mean, you know, it still works. I can still do it. That's what they care about. I care about it not because, well, I mean, it's nice to have, you know, whatever, a car that you can get instead of a taxi or whatever, and it's a lot easier and blah, blah, blah. But the point of it is what it means about our ability to interact with other human beings. And if we don't understand it to that level, then as I say, it will always be controlled in some way from up top. They'll always come in and try to sweep it up. So yeah, I think I'd love to believe that we will just kind of stumble into this technologically and, you know, 3D printing and whatever will revolutionize everything to the point where we're all just anarchists by default.
Yeah.
But I don't see that happening because the people who have, you know, funded this technology into existence and control the main companies that are the ones, you know, that control a lot of this technology are not just going to hand people anarchism on a platter.
Mm.
They are quite the opposite. They're going to hand people technology and gugads and fondle slabs and all of the things that we love to play with as a way of getting us kind of sleepwalking into this, the kind of ultimate system of control. So it has to be done consciously, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're doing great work to make that become a reality. Just in closing, do you have any other ideas about people who are interested and excited about the idea of a free society? Like, what kinds of things could they do besides visit your website? And
No, that's it. Just visit. I think it's more about action. What you actually implement in your life than it is about talking about it. I think